Good morning. This is the radio service of the University of Illinois, WILL in Urbana, returning to the air for another day.
These are the sounds of WILL in its 50th year on the air. In the next hour, we'll bring you an audio portrait of our colorful history with the sounds of sign-on. Good morning, and welcome to Illini Time Part 1. Today we will...
This invitation to listen to WILL begins our day with the sounds of fine music. We continue to present outstanding selections of music, sports events, agricultural news, public affairs, discussions, lectures, children's features, and drama on the University of the Air. But where did this service to the citizens of the state of Illinois begin? What were the sounds of sign-on 50 years ago? In the midst of Morse code and high-pitched squeals, Illinois residents heard sporadic broadcasts from radio station 9XJ. In 1921, this station was part of an experiment in the electrical engineering laboratories of the University of Illinois. Faculty and students worked with crystal receivers to pick out 9XJ, the forerunner of WILL. On March 28, 1922, the University of Illinois was granted a license to operate a radio transmitter on 834 kilocycles with 400 watts of power from 7 until 10 each evening. WRM became the call letters of this infant station. The handmade transmitter with fragile vacuum tubes and brittle wiring was subject to whim and fancy and rarely broadcast on a regular schedule. But dedicated listeners heard the latest scores of athletic events on campus and even appreciated live music. Joseph Wright, first director of the station, recalls these days.
Hugh Brown, professor of electrical engineering, had built a small transmitter of 100 watts or so for an experimental project, and that was the only thing the university had in the real early days. He dubbed it WRM. Most of us called it the worm, and he said, no, that means we reach millions.
Then came a gift earmarked for the struggling station, not yet 5 years old.
Construction of a permanent building for the radio station began at the south end of Illinois Field, behind Men's Old Gymnasium. A new transmitter and towers helped broadcast news from this building. Joseph Wright explains the source of these marked improvements.
Without conferring with the president of the university or anyone else, a gentleman by the name of Boetius E. Sullivan of Chicago announced through the front page headline of the Chicago Tribune that he had given the university a Western Electric 1,000-watt transmitter as a memorial for his father, who was a Roger Sullivan, a Democratic boss in Illinois for a long time. He said he just as a means of, I'm quoting, as a means of education for the boys and girls of the state of Illinois to whom my father was so endeared. Well, he had also, all of this without knowledge to us, arranged for a license, federal license.
University of Illinois President Kinley was particularly interested in this growing radio station. Again, Joseph Wright.
Yes, and he was very emphatic in the fact that the gift was not to be used as an engineering training vehicle, that this was the sort of thing that could eventually reach a tremendous number of people, and that's what he wanted to do and develop. He said, maybe someday we will take classroom lectures to the people, which we did, a great series of fine lectures like Garner used to do.
These ties to the University of Illinois were recognized in our new call letters, WILL, acquired in 1928. Not only did our call letters change, but in 1935, our frequency shifted to 580 kilocycles, our present AM frequency.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked
As President Roosevelt's remarks at the start of World War II were being relayed to radio listeners, WILL was planning to broadcast from a new home in Gregory Hall. Quarters at the south end of Illinois Field had become too cramped. Station manager Frank E. Schooley perched on a balcony. File cabinets practically marched up the stairs, and rehearsals were held on the stair steps as staff members typed below. And so, classrooms at Gregory Hall were temporarily remodeled at the outbreak of the war. It was at this time that we assumed our new title, The University of the Air. Just before World War II, WILL added another facet, FM. In 1941, a license was issued for WIUC-FM, the first license given to a non-commercial educational FM station. Chief Engineer A. James Ebel directed the construction of our first FM transmitter. The original frequency assignment, 42.5 megacycles, shifted to 91.7 and finally to 90.9 megacycles. The call letters of our FM station changed also in 1954 to WILL-FM, while John Brueger was chief engineer. As technical facilities improved, our program features changed, but never our essential policy. The basic premise of WILL has been to bring the rich talents and information of the University of Illinois campus to the citizens of the state. WILL taps such sources as the School of Music, the College of Agriculture, the University Extension staff, in fact, every branch of the university. Their research and knowledge comes to our listeners in learned and in entertaining forms. The first listeners of WILL followed athletic events on campus, and for 50 years we have presented news of all the major sports events on campus. When the Fighting Illini traveled to the basketball courts to play Northwestern, A. James Ebel recounted the event.
15 seconds left to play. Haypack is dribbling up the floor, and Haypack was fouled by Shepard. Haypack was fouled intentionally by Shepard. He's not going to take the free throw. Northwestern's doing everything possible to get a hold of this ball in these last few seconds. 14 seconds left to play. Apec has the ball out of bounds. The pass is in the backcourt to Sachs. Sachs taking all the time he can to Shapiro. Shapiro up across the center line for Illinois. The ball is almost taken away from him. He stops, pass over to Evers. Evers out to Apec. 1 second left to play. The ball is way up in the air. Apec threw it high in the air so no one could shoot that ball. And Illinois wins by a 35-33 count. In a hair-raising basketball game, if there ever was a hair-raising basketball game.
And at the close of a contest with Ohio, Frank Schooley was on hand to encourage listeners to join us again for more sports broadcasts.
Thank you, Frank Beach, for your description of the Illinois-Ohio University football game this afternoon. The first intercollegiate game of the 1938 season, and Ohio wins, Ohio University wins from the University of Illinois, 6-0. 6-0. The score coming in the third quarter on a pass from Montgomery to Snyder, who ran down toward the northeastern corner of the gridiron and went over standing up for the only score of the game. Montgomery's attempted placement, kick from placement for the extra point failed, and Ohio made the only score of the game in the third quarter, winning 6-0. Now Coach Bob Zepke has walked over to his former pupil, Don Peden, and congratulated him. They're standing out there on the gridiron talking. Now they separate, Bob Zepke going toward the Illinois dressing room, Don Peden walking across the field to the northwest part of the stadium, northwest dressing room, the visiting dressing room, and the first intercollegiate football game of the season, 1938, is over. Remember, next Saturday afternoon at 2:30 o'clock, DePaul and Illinois. DePaul and Illinois, 1 week from today, 2 weeks from today, Indiana University and the Illini meet here in the first conference game for the Illini.
In fact, in 1937, on a trip to Iowa City to cover a basketball game, Frank Schooley is rumored to have spent a night in jail rather than pay a parking fine for the WILL station truck. Others wonder if he just ran out of gas. Musical selections have always been a part of WILL, but the type of music has varied over the years. In the beginning, WILL featured Joe Robbins and his band, Matt Matthews and his orchestra, and other local bands. But the University of Illinois band, with Austin Harding as director, was also popular. Up to half of a typical broadcast day on WILL has been devoted to music. First, live bands and local concerts. Then, in 1930, a phonograph library added to our repertoire. A studio orchestra was formed in 1940 to assist in dramatic productions and musical presentations. Cooperation with the School of Music helped inaugurate the Illini Faculty Concert Series. The first, in 1947, featured the Walden String Quartet.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The School of Music of the University of Illinois presents the Walden String Quartet in the first of the Illini Faculty Concert Series. Our program begins this afternoon with portions of the Haydn Quartet in C major, Opus 20, number 2.
Staff members involved in musical programming worked first under the direction of Arthur Cohen, then Lanson Deming. In 1946, Kenneth Cutler became music director and even performed on the organ for broadcast. Over the years, themes of certain programs have become part of the audio history of WILL. Let's listen. Now, that's Illini time, at the start of the day on WILL. And later in the morning, the Chamber Music Hour. As evening comes, music of the masters begins, and fine music also appears on Orchestra Hall. Listeners joined students in the classroom as well. Scattered across campus were remote hookups for microphones used by professors in sociology, economics, the fine arts. In one semester, over 40 courses were broadcast over WILL. Just before World War II,
Professor Albert H. Leibeyer addressed his students about the hazards of Hitler's European policy.
Now, there's no mention here of the Jewish element. There's a considerable Jewish element in Austria who would, if under a Nazi regime, be more or less persecuted. I'd better say less or more, because that is the order in which it would take place in all probability, as in Germany.
And just a decade ago, Professor Norman Graebner took another look at the politics of power.
American power in this century has brought victory in two great world wars. It has stabilized a Cold War. But power even of such magnitude will not do everything. On record, in fact, its use in winning wars rather than preventing wars has brought relatively few genuine gains. Indeed, the United States, with all of its power and all of its victory in war, is not as secure today as it was 60 years ago.
In 1935, a discussion series featured amateur radio operators, especially appropriate since many staff members were hams. After a few years on the air, this program took a look back.
Forum, America's oldest program devoted exclusively to the radio amateur, presents It's History in Drama. Six years of Ham Forum. A birthday broadcast. Today we dramatize the high spots of the last 6 years of Ham Forum.
In the fall of 1934 and in the early winter of 1935, there was a faint buzzing in the minds of two gentlemen connected with this station, WILF. These gentlemen both held amateur radio licenses. Both felt it would be a great service to hams and radio in general if a program for all radio amateur operators could be inaugurated. One of these ops was an old-timer. W9CMZ, W.E. Phillips, then chief engineer of this station. The other was a young punk, by his own admission, W9MLH, Bill Livesey, then announcer on the WILL staff. Finally, one day in March, when the idea of a ham forum program was fairly well formulated in the minds of these two hams, they called on Frank Schooley, program director.
The idea of a ham program is all right, but what sort of an audience will we have? We could hardly justify a program on the basis of a handful of ham listeners.
There'll be more than a handful of ham listeners to this program, Mr. Schooley. All the boys on the 80-meter band think that a program like this would be just the stuff.
I'm not so sure, Frank, that the listeners will be confined to radio amateurs. There are droves of people who are interested in ham radio, but who don't have licenses.
Who's going to be responsible for this program?
I'll take that on.
You're sure that you have enough material to fill a 15-minute period once a week?
I can talk about ham radio for 15 minutes any day.
Well, there's a 15-minute spot at 10:15 on Saturday morning. How would that suit you?
Fine business, eh, Phil?
Yes, that ought to do the trick. Now
In 1937, WILL recognized religious concerns in the first broadcast of Student Churches. A program still on the air today. Speakers from religious foundations on campus presented their viewpoints each morning and brought religious news to our audience. Ideas culled from the world's greatest drama were also being presented by students and staff. Under the direction of the production department, works by Shakespeare, Crane, Bronte, and others were enacted. Let's hear a few lines from our presentation of Richard III.
Tales from Shakespeare.
Richard III, the WILL Playhouse presents Richard III by William Shakespeare. Richard, whom is known for his role in Henry VI, reaches his bloody throne over the dead bodies of his murdered relatives. But the power and the glory bring him little happiness before his own death. Yet, in spite of his cruelty, here is a character. Meet Richard, Duke of Gloucester, and watch him become Richard III.
Is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the sun of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front, and now instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries...
And this suspense from Wuthering Heights.
At my first glimpse of Wuthering Heights, I stopped dead. My impulse was to turn my back on its somber foreboding and retreat to the cheerfulness of my own house. The gray mist that rose about it seemed like giant cobwebs caught in the turrets. But I continued my way towards a massive door with its grotesque carvings. On the crumbling cornerstone, I detected the date 1500 and the name Hareton Earnshaw. I knocked. The sensation I had upon first seeing Wuthering Heights was repeated. And I looked into the cold, dark eyes of my landlord.
Dramatic moments such as these were not restricted to studio theater. The Romance of the Lincoln Soybean was produced by the College of Agriculture, only a part of the news brought to Midwestern farmers. By 1928, specialists from the College of Agriculture were addressing listeners on land, crops, livestock, and other concerns of Illinois agriculture. In 1936, remarks by the dean of the college, Eugene Davenport, put into perspective the situation for farmers.
It is not the old men who are leaving the farms. The men who cleared these farms are not drawn away, but they're aging. They're getting of old very fast, and the undertaker is busy among them. What are the young men doing? What is the character of the men who are going to the factories? I'm not concerned at all with the drift of population from the country to the town. It's good for both modes of life, but I'd like to know the character of the draft.
In 1934, specialists started to present news for Illinois farmers 4 days a week on WILL. And in 1935, WILL began a regular broadcast of the market prices from Lowell Hoyt & Company. Farmers throughout the Midwest learned to depend on WILL for up-to-the-minute information on prevailing market prices and in-depth comments on farming problems. Ted Mangner acted as host for his program between 1937 and 1944. In 1945 and 46, E.H. Regner expanded the farm hour to a full hour in length, 6 days a week. And then Bob Beeler took over the duties of talking with agricultural specialists. But one day, these three men reminisced on the 3,000th broadcast of the farm hour.
I'll never forget the time when three of us were broadcasting a roundtable discussion, and one fellow pulled two pages instead of one. And one fellow asked him the question. He says, "What kind of land is that down there in southwestern Arkansas?" And the other man who had pulled another page says, "That'll cost you 5.5% interest on your investment." And that's what you call cross questions and silly answers. It still happens.
Has anything ever like that ever happened to you while you had the farm hour, Duke?
Yes, all too frequently, I suppose. But I don't think we want to let this one go. That's a classic in the way of, I think, helping to prevent people who have the nervous habit of doodle-bugging. That's the kind of thing that you do when you take a pencil out of your pocket, you know, and draw all kind of characters on your script or on the paper that happens to be in front of you. Well, when you drop a pencil a couple of times and look at the engineer through the glass in the control room, why, that breaks you that habit. But the thing that I'm getting at, Ted, was the fortunate or unfortunate circumstance developed with a said gallus on one farm hour back in the early days. I don't know whether we should let the folks in on that or not.
Well, I've heard about that. I just wish I'd like to have a first-hand report of what did go on, Ted.
Well, you asked for it. You'll get it. It was a very hot day in July about 6 or 7 years ago, and I imagine a lot of the people are still wondering what caused the terrific uproar in that studio. I might mention the fact that I was broadcasting without a coat on, and the clips in my suspenders were getting a little old while the elastic was still good. So I stuck my thumb in my suspender as I pulled that suspender out a little bit and said, "Hello, everyone," like we started the Illinois Farm Hour, and the buckle came loose, hitting me right above the eye. And I thought someone had thrown a rock at me, and I ducked, and both of them came loose in the back, and I think we better leave the discussion right there.
Later, Bob Beeler joined Harold Hill, program director, to describe the antics at the All-Ag Field Day. Harold Hill attempted to describe a pie-eating contest.
There they go. They're starting to that pie. They're leaning over that shell just as hard as they can eat. They've got whipped cream from their ear to ear. They've just got it all over them. You'd think they were shaving in the morning. I don't know how they're ever going to get that crust out of that pie, but they're getting the pumpkin out just as fast as they can. As I told you, they have to keep their hands behind them. There's one fellow that seems to be a little behind. He's not doing so well. But the defending champion right here in a bright red shirt doesn't seem to be doing as well as some of the other contestants. It seems that after every bite, he has to raise his head and swallow, which rather slows him down. However, I do believe that his whipped cream is a little more gooey than the rest of the whipped creams. Here's one fellow over here who uses kind of a sweeping grazing motion. He sticks his face into the pie and pulls a backward scoop with his teeth and just scoops it up like a shovel. And this fellow right here in front of me now is getting a little piece of the plate with it. I believe their pies are on paper plates. I believe this boy's got a little bit of the paper plate. Here's a boy over here. Looks like he's just about to win. He's just about got the pie eaten. He's just about through. He's just about got it all eaten. He's got all the pie out of it and all but the crust. Now it looks like number two man has won.
Settings for the Farm Hour varied, but even ordinary conversation with one host, Bill Mason, was enlivened by the sounds of spring on the lawn in front of Gregory Hall. A microphone hanging out the window of the studio picked up his remarks below. Advice about insect controls, harvesting practices, fertilizing schedules, all of these were relayed to the farmer on WILL. Philosophical commentary on life in the Illinois countryside was the topic of Professor A.W. Nolan on the program Rural Life Review from 1929 until 1946. This was just one of the attempts made by WILL to reach town and country. Frank E. Schooley, station manager, chatted with the manager of the Iowa State College radio station about serving these listeners.
Our concept is that people living in the rural areas are people like living in other areas within our society. Now, their interests, they have special interests, and perhaps at times because of their geographical location within our service area, we have to keep that in mind. But I like to think of a person living in a rural area just being another member of our society. And we don't program especially a period of day, say, or two periods a day, or certain periods within a week, and aim them at those in the rural areas only with the expectation that they're not going to listen to our other program, because we like to think that our overall programming for the state of Illinois and other areas is for the people living in rural areas and in urban areas. Now, there are certain times of the day, it's true, that we try to meet the special needs of those living in rural areas, but we also hope that they are listening and interested in our other overall programming.
This tune became part of each morning on WILL, a half hour of news for homemakers on For You at Home. But let Jesse Heathman, hostess for the program starting in 1945, explain its purpose to Hugh Cordier, a producer for WILL at the time.
Jesse, tell me, your work is coordinating the information from the research laboratories and communities and presenting it to the homemakers in this area. Isn't that right?
Yes, Hugh, but my work, my programs aren't limited to homemaking, you know. I think that can best be explained by the motto of members of our Home Economics Extension Division. Their motto is this: the home should be the center of every woman's interest, but not the circumference.
Mm-hmm. And that's the basis of your radio programs, to help the homemaker in her work and to bring her valuable information about other interests.
That's right, and of course, guests from all over the campus and from the community and the state participate in these programs and give helpful information about these other interests.
One of Jesse's regular guests was Duke Regner, and after World War II, he talked with her about the changed character of recreation activities around the state of Illinois. This conversation was part of another program, The Homemaker's Quarter Hour, broadcast first in 1937.
Good afternoon, homemakers. This is your quarter hour, presented Monday through Friday by the Home Economics Department of the University of Illinois. We are here this afternoon to talk about the future, to talk about what's ahead. You know, the end of war has brought many changes, changes that have to do with our way of life, changes that need to be considered. And our extension specialists, who have to do with program plans for groups out in the state, report a number of changes that are taking place so far as programs are concerned. And one thing that is very outstanding, they say, is an increase in requests for more music, requests for more community get-togethers, and for more recreation. Of course, another indication is a request from 4-H Club and rural youth leaders for more camps. Last year here in Illinois, approximately 85 camps, and that included the state, district, and county camps, were held for 4-H Club and rural youth groups. And even more camps have been requested for this season. Well, now, this reaction, of course, for more social activities is only natural after a strenuous period of war as we have just experienced. But, on the other hand, it does mean that very careful program planning and wise program planning is needed. Now, in order to get a bird's eye view of the situation here in Illinois, I've asked Duke Regner of our Extension Rural Sociology staff to give us his opinion this afternoon, to tell us some of the things we need to keep in mind, as guideposts in our planning. All right, Duke, come in and tell us about it. What do you think about this situation? This is all these requests coming in for more community meetings, more get-together parties, and more music, more recreation in general.
Yes, I think perhaps it might be an accumulated want or need that's occurred during the war. Unfortunately, some of our neighboring states folded up the recreation program, as it were.
I know, and Duke, I have always had a feeling that that was not wise, because after all, we talk about time being needed for war work. That is true.
That's
but
right.
Unless mm-hmm. we play a little bit or relax a little bit along the way, we're not going to work very efficiently.
That's right. I'm proud, though, of our show in Illinois. That is the showing we made in our recreation, because although it was a coasting program, we didn't put on anything elaborate, but we did get along with the things that we had learned in previous training schools, and we got together in little groups and shared experiences with each other on the brief moments that we would have.
Another program broadcast on WILL spanned four decades, from the 30s through the 60s, and was produced by Mrs. C.C. Wiley. On Parent Teacher Forum, she highlighted educational news and presented such guests as noted educator J. Lloyd Trump.
Someone has said that the most important visual aid in the classroom is a teacher himself. The teacher should be an interesting person. He should have a variety of hobbies, travel experiences, interests, and broad reading background. There is no place for the dull, unglamorous, uninteresting person in the teaching profession. The typical cartoon idea of a teacher with broad-rimmed spectacles, a long face, interested only in books, should not be a reality in our schools.
One program series even took to the skies. Wings Over Illinois was broadcast on WILL in 1947. In recognition of the new aeronautical facilities at the University of Illinois.
Institute of Aeronautics at the University of Illinois introduces Wings Over Illinois, a new Saturday afternoon feature of station WILL. Each week, you hear interesting details of the part the university plays in education for the air age. Yes, it is an Illinois policy to meet the demand for varied educational and research programs geared to the amazing growth of air transport.
From news of aviation, other speakers turn to such topics as genetic engineering and African dance patterns. Visiting lecturers spoke to students and faculty, and often to WILL's listeners. Their remarks were presented on Guest Speaker. Here's a sample of recent comments.
A young man once gave me what he thought was his highest compliment. You think like a man, but expected to be treated like a lady. So I say to a new male staff member when he's come up with a fine idea, you think like a woman. He squirms.
Stop being ashamed of the way we talked. I don't know why them colored folks don't apply themselves and learn how to speak the English language good like us white folks in America. You know, I wish all you white folks in America could get on a jet plane one day and fly to London, England, and listen to that Englishman talk. And you'd find out you can't speak English neither.
When I first heard, got to studying about computers and found out what marvelous instruments they were, I threatened to introduce a proposed constitutional amendment to make a computer eligible for election to the office of the president. Then I went down and I studied something about computers. And I was told that a computer could make logical deductions from the facts stored in its memory banks, but it could not make illogical deductions. I thereupon abandoned my proposal.
A special Christmas feature has charmed the hearts of young and old since the 1940s. Announcer Phil Spradling asks us to listen to Dickens' immortal Christmas Carol.
The Christmas season carries with it an air of expectancy. There are packages to be opened, carols and callers, sleigh bells and mistletoe, and all the wonderful traditions that go to make the holiday the exciting occasion it is. In fact, on such a festive occasion, you'd hardly expect to find a man with an attitude like this.
If I had my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart.
However, that's Scrooge. You've met him before, no doubt, in Dickens' famous Christmas story. You'll meet him again in just a moment as Paul Landis of the University of Illinois' Department of English retells this heartwarming account of the events that occurred during a Christmas season in England. Now, Professor Paul Landis, as he's recorded A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens.
Marley was dead, to begin with. There's no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it. And Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to.
The written words of old and new authors also receive special attention from staff members at the University of Illinois Library. The Library Presents was a regular feature on WILL for many years. Harold Longcore reported from the library in the 50s, and then in the 60s, Bob Orham began his comments on books in the news.
It seems incredible that that wrinkled old bivalve, the oyster, has occasioned so many books recently. I don't mean the usual deluge of biological monographs or articles buried in scientific society publications. I mean honest-to-God books, full of meat, if you pardon the expression, and meant to be read with the common folk. Now, Eleanor Clark, wife of Robert Penn Warren, has put on our reading plates The Oysters of Lochmariachay, a book published by Pantheon. Miss Clark tells us promptly that she's not speaking of that of those weazened oysters we see lurching about on the half-shell in restaurants or those resting in watery, half-frozen graves in supermarkets. She's writing of a special oyster, that raised in Locmariaque, which is a small, almost infinitesimal village in Brittany in northern France. This oyster, almost never imported to this country, is rarely seen on any but the most elegant of continental menus. It's usually called the Americaine or Bailon and is a flat oyster, as oysters go.
Programs produced by WILL gained the attention of other broadcasters, and awards were presented for special efforts. The news analyses of Quincy Howe, noted CBS News commentator who came to WILL between 1950 and 53, were given a special citation by Ohio State University's Institute for Education by Radio and Television. Quincy Howe also participated in a special discussion on the Bill of Rights. Don Brown, news director at WILL, asked Howe an opening question in this program, which won the American Civil Liberties Union Prize.
Well, this First Amendment is the one that I'm sure is referred to more than all others by the average person. Well, how does it fit into the present crisis? As you were indicating at the beginning of the broadcast, Mr. Howe, just how much free speech should a communist have?
According to the Constitution and according to my own opinion, a communist should, of course, have exactly the same rights of free speech as anybody else. That is, he should have the right of free speech until he becomes a clear and present danger. Now, communists aren't the only ones who can become clear and present dangers. The right of free speech does not permit a person to shout fire in a crowded theater. That's an old way of illustrating it. But there should be no particular restrictions applied against communists because they're communists or against communists merely for talking. You can put restrictions against communists for other reasons, but not merely for what they say.
And recognition for the children's program series, Stories and Stuff, came from Ohio State University competition. This half-hour series won first place in children's programs for out-of-school listening and captured the hearts of children across Illinois for 16 years. Edna Engineer, actually Edna Haney, engineer since 1943, recorded the antics of the original cast members, Winnie Taft, Marg Goralski, and Phil Spradling. Later, John Regnell, Louise Geislers, and Marg Phillipson assumed such roles as dragons, famous composers, and princes. Here's an invitation to one program.
Hello there, boys and girls. This is Marg. Would you like to hear the story about the prince with 100 dragons? Well, just listen, and you will.
And now, just a bit of that drama from Stories and Stuff. First, a dragon bemoaning his fate, and then a pig talking with a turtle.
I know what happens to dragons who come down out of the wild mountains. Of course I do. Why, they get made into suitcases and billfolds and bedroom slippers. Ooh.
He shivered again.
I don't want to be made into bedroom slippers. Not even for a king, no!
He rocked.
Hello there, Turtle. Gee, who was that singing?
Mind your own business. That's my rule. He who talks is a terrible fool.
Oh, you're very rude.
Better rude than stewed.
At the close of the program, the Wigglewog family often appeared with mother and father, twins, Tilly and Billy, the car, Wigglebump, and their dog, Wigglewags. Of course, sound effects have been an important part of many of these dramatic programs on WILL. Listeners hear bacon frying, but it's actually cellophane crackling. Weary travelers trudging through snowbanks are really crunching through cornstarch. A door frame holding a screen door and a wooden door in the WILL studios has received countless angry slams. and a special squeak on a wooden chair has sent a chill down many spines. A large library of recorded sound effects has augmented live sound effects. After all, an ocean liner or a jet airplane just won't fit in our recording studios. Recent documentaries have featured garbage trucks unloading, computers singing, and even whales.
There, Leviathan, hugest of living creatures, in the deep, stretched like a promontory, sleeps or swims, and seems a moving land, and at his gills draws in, and at his breath spouts out a sea.
Those were the opening moments of the documentary On Whales by Whales. And here are the sounds of a series about the impact of computers on modern man, Do Not Fold. Do not fold, bend, staple, or mutilate this card. The slogan of the computer age. The University of Illinois Radio Service presents a series of programs about you and the computer. From banks to hospitals, and from airlines to music, its applications seem endless. These programs will give you a glimpse of these countless applications and what they mean to you. From that series, one of the high points was a Bell Labs computer singing this ditty.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm crazy, all for the love of you. It would be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
WILL has become particularly aware of the history of Illinois after 150 years of statehood, and the history of the University of Illinois at its centennial year. Two series commemorated these important moments. They Came to Illinois and A Century of Ours. Special lyrics set to the music of the traditional folk song Illinois opened 26 programs in the series They Came to Illinois.
The lonely backwoods trappers with muskets and few goods first built their drafty shelters in prairie grass and woods, but soon there followed others with bold plans to employ their life upon the prairie in the state of Illinois. They brought their families westward with hopes for help and joy. They crossed the mighty rivers and they came to Illinois.
They came to Illinois to find a new life in the West. They were alone, in families, in groups. They were restless, wanted land or a fresh start in new territory. This series of programs is about how they lived and how they fared when they came to Illinois.
They brought their families.
The Alt Guild Chimes provided the theme for A Century of Ours, an audio history of the University of Illinois.
A Century of Ours. The history of 100 years at the University of Illinois is dedicated to the people who founded and shaped a center of higher education. These men were committed to teaching, research, and service in the state of Illinois. Over 400,000 students have crossed the campuses of the University of Illinois in pursuit of academic excellence. This is the story of their legacy.
So we look at our own history on this special program on our 50th birthday. On March 28, 1922, we began our service to the state of Illinois with the sporadic broadcasts of WRM, newly licensed to transmit from the campus of the University of Illinois. In this past hour, we have given you a bird's eye view of five decades. Sports, drama, agricultural news, classroom lectures, and public affairs. From past broadcasts on WILL AM and FM. But now, though this program comes to a close, we do not sign off. We look forward to another 50 years of broadcasting with these Sounds of Sinon.
Thank you.